League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to Richard Crowe, a.k.a. Cockney Rebel, on social media and one of the UK's finest investors. So welcome, Richard.
Well, you picked me up there, Paul. I'm going to live up to that one now.
No, you've got a great reputation. Investors might be aware that Richard and I have been having a bit of a sort of like a jovial game of ping pong on Twitter in terms of where the market's heading. So maybe we can start there. Given the sort of the dire predictions by many sort of like, you know, global bulge bracket strategists in terms of where the economy is heading, particularly after the sort of the mini banking crisis, why in your view has equities been so resilient, in fact been positive in terms of the first quarter and all the first 4 months?
Well, I always think when we got to partly way through last year, there seems so much gloom written in the market, and there always is a lot of gloom. And when I hear everybody telling me everything's going to be dreadful, I'm really cautious. Yeah, I'm really sort of like bullish. Yeah. And when people are ever so bullish, it's the old Buffett thing, you know, buy when people are fearful and sell when people are greedy. And it just looked like that to me last year, that everybody was so bearish. We've gone through about a year of a fall in the S&P. And the average length of a fall in the S&P isn't usually much more than a year. The worst ones can get to about 2 years, but also, you know, various other things I saw, you know, everyone was saying, oh, oil's going to $200. And, you know, I've been here before, and oil doesn't go to $200. Oil gets to about 110, 120, and then it becomes self-fulfilling prophecy that oil starts to go down again, because you can see a recession coming. Everybody doesn't want to buy oil anymore because the recession's coming. So it's like a automatic stabilizer, really, the price of oil. And when everybody was saying it was going to, you know, $200, I thought the top was 120, and there it was. It was there. I put it on Twitter that I thought that was the top, and I just like being contrarian. It's probably the rebel in me. The word rebel comes, you know, is in my name, because I like, when everybody's doing one thing, I like to be doing something. I like to rebel against them.
Yeah, well, I've definitely been on the more sort of like course. I'm naturally actually a more bullish, optimistic side, but certainly this year I've got a sort of like a cautious outlook. So if you're right, how long is it going to last for? Is it going to continue for the rest of the year? I mean, particularly, you know, in terms of, let's just assume the economy, the consumer hangs in there doing really well. China reopens, inflation, you know, continues to sort of like soften, but stays sticky, because I think that's where a lot of the people reckon it'll be, sort of 3 or 4%. And, you know, interest rates stay at sort of like, you know, what the banks are saying they're going to stay at the central banks. Is the sort of the good days going to continue to roll?
Well, you know, I'm not going to guarantee anything for anybody. That I, you know, what I say, I could change my mind tomorrow if I see something different. So, you know, who was it that said, you know, when I see, when the facts change, I change my mind. Yeah. But at the moment, really, I see, you know, we came into this, and I think sort of, you know, a year or so ago, who would have thought the central banks could raise interest rates this high without crashing the economy. Mm. You would, you know, I would heard so many people say, you know, they'll never be able to, as soon as they start raising interest rates, we're dead. And it hasn't happened. And, you know, and at the moment now, I think people have, you know, we've got over the bit where the market's gone down. The S&P's not cheap in anyone's book.
Yeah, 19 times.
Yeah, I don't do US stocks, you know. So I'm looking at that index and it looks to me like the S&P's treading water. Some people want it to go up and they want to buy it. Other people know it's too expensive and it's just marking its time and gradually working its way into the price, really. So the PE is working its way down while earnings are going up, and it'll probably go. I would think the S&P will go sideways for some time. I can't see it sort of actually taking off. But
yeah.
Around the world, there's a lot of other places where things are cheap, and because everybody was going on, you know, Goldman Sachs 22% inflation they were forecasting about a year ago.
Well, 22?
22, I think they got to.
Yeah, it feels like that for my PG tips down Tesco.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's what they were forecasting. They might be right underneath, underlying inflation, maybe at 22%. The figures we're being given, you know, and everybody says, oh, everything's going up so much. But, you know, the gloom on inflation a year ago was just so gloomy. And I couldn't believe 22% was, or, you know, I think it might have been JP Morgan said 18%, or one of the other big US ones said 18% here. So they were trying to out-Trump each other on, you know, how high they went. And I just thought at that point, that's too gloomy. It's not going to get there. And now, sort of people have been expecting inflation to come down. It hasn't come down as quick as people had been hoping. But that's something else that I've noticed happens in the past. Everybody sort of gets too enthusiastic and they expect too much too quick. And then your sentiment changes and everybody suddenly thinks, oh, well, inflation isn't going to come down as fast as we thought. But in the next few months, there's quite a few numbers coming out, like UK natural gas is down to about a tenth of where it was in August last year. That's going to work its way into the price over the next 6 months to a year. Petrol's down 20% from where it was. And in actual fact, this month, April last year, petrol went up 10% in April. So when April drops out, that's another big one that's going to drop out year-on-year inflation figures. So I think now people are getting, you know, their expectations are being a bit more realistic about where inflation is. You might start getting some positive surprises. And that's what gives the market another kick. But that's what it is, isn't it? Someone, you get a positive surprise. Everyone gets over enthusiastic. They get disappointed because it comes off a bit. And that's what markets do. Over enthusiasm, under enthusiasm, pessimism. And it's all about that. But I think, you know, sort of when you get to January or February next year, I think sort of like inflation outlook, something's got to happen to keep the inflation down. Whether that's another, you know, interest rate hike, I don't know. But I think up until Christmas, the inflation looks like it's going to be on the way down and people might be comfortable for at least another 6 to 9 months of investing and, you know,
I certainly agree with you. I, given where the sort of direction of travel, a lot of the sort of consumer sort of like, you know, stocks in terms of the travel, the leisure, the airlines, restaurants, hotels. I mean, they're just, and even places like, you know, the theme parks, they're just having a boom time, no doubt about it. And I think people have, it's turned out better than feared with energy and with a warm winter in terms of, you know, where it's going to be. So, at the moment, the economy looks really strong. And then in terms of sort of like, you know, because obviously you're a really good stock picker, which areas are sort of like attractive to you? Is it really those sort of like hot, strong areas now, or are you sort of like looking elsewhere for other opportunities?
Well, I sort of learned, well, it took me a while to learn, but I've learned to stick to what I understand.
Okay.
What I know and stick to stuff that's easy. I used to do...
You don't know Warren Buffett, do you, by any chance?
No, but yeah, he
gives you a ring occasionally.
He speaks a lot of sense, doesn't he? You know, you can't ignore a guy with that much experience and stuff. And over the course of time, gradually you realise, I started off life as a milkman.
Okay.
And I used to go to milk yards. And when I was a lad, the milkman used to say to me, wear a jacket around your back, keep your back warm, because in the cold, you'll pull your muscles in the back. And you sit there and you think, oh, silly old sod, what does he know? Went out one day with my back cold, lift up a bunch of milk crates, bang, the back went. And you realise, at that point, I realised these old boys, you know, experience.
Yeah.
You can't buy experience. And that's what you get over 20 years or 25 years of doing this like I've been doing. You start to pick up the experience that, you know, all the mistakes you've made, at least you've learned from those over the time, and you hope. So I try to stick to you know, I like retailers and consumer stocks because they're so easy. You can wander around a shop and go and have a look and see what they're doing. I like engineering companies and manufacturing companies, quite like those. I don't mind a bit of tech if I understand it, if I think I understand it. I avoid oil, energy, you know.
They're too dependent on the commodity price.
Yeah, like Mike Twain said, holding the ground with a lyre at the top.
Yes, okay. And,
most of them are like that, you know. It's all we think we've got this much down there. Well, yeah, maybe you have, but there's so many hurdles to get over between what's down there that might be down there and getting it to the ground, to the top. But I think if you specialize in that type of thing, if you do just oils and you really understand it well and you can have a spread of oil stocks, you know, likelihood is you're going to get one that sort of absolutely bust the gut and gives you a 10 bagger or 100 bagger. And that's probably the way to do it. But if you dot about in one or another and you don't really know that much about what you're doing, well, I don't. And
no,
so
I think you're right. I think you raise a really good point in terms of, you know, when you go into sort of commodity stocks, then the hit rate can be really low, particularly in the small cap area. And you have to get the underlying commodity right, as well as the company and the management team right, to add that extra layer of sort of like complexity. I guess you didn't make any money out of Dairy Crest when you got taken out, did you? About sort of like 10 years ago, being that milkman.
No,
insight.
I actually saw it happen. I saw the price going up, and I dabbled with it, but I was
you were well reticent to jump in.
Yeah, the sell by date was off the top of the bottle by then.
Okay, right. Well, we'll look for other potential takeovers. In fact, I think you've had quite a few recently. But just before we move on to that one area again, I mean, you've been long, you know, you've been through this before, like the great financial crisis, but we are seeing now an increasing number of companies sort of delisting. And we had one, iEnergizer, which was about a £500 million business that got taken out by its Indian. How do you sort of treat that, and how do you avoid it in terms of sort of like these delistings?
Well, it's a big the guy running that had a big holding, about 80%, didn't he? So
I think he was the founder of Vedanta age years and years ago. It's a familiar name.
It's always dangerous when one guy's got, you know, so much of a holding that, you know, sort of, so something like that where someone had 80%, I don't think I would have got involved anyway. So but you know, we're dealing with AIM, and AIM can be it's a bandit land, isn't it? You know, sort of like a
cowboy country.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. And it's got worse over the last, you know, 20 years ago, everyone used to say to me, oh, watch AIM because it was difficult. And it went for a spell where it was, you know, improving itself, but just of lately, you know, One Disco and stuff like that, you just sit there and think, how do these things happen in this day and age, you know, on a regulated market? And,
I actually think it's cleaned up. I remember the days of sort of like all those Chinese stocks which came on.
Oh, yeah. I just left those alone. After I watched one or two, you know, you just thought, well, this is just, it's just danger money. You just no point in even entertaining. And some of these Israeli stocks as well, few of them. Rarely does an Israeli stock come good. I always sort of look where the things incorporated first and Chinese, Israeli, Hong Kong. It sounds ever so racist, but just on
right. It isn't racist at all. It's just a fact of life.
The governance. I think out in the Chinese culture, gambling is a much greater thing out there. Gambling is almost a way of life in the Chinese culture. And whether they accidentally get it wrong or intentionally get things wrong, but a high proportion of them just went, and you don't see a Chinese company on there now. So
Well, I mean, it doesn't mean that UK companies don't also fall foul of megalomaniacs, sort of like, you know, this, sort of like CEOs. I used to work for Marconi, and look where that ended up.
So,
that was my sins a long time ago. Now let's move on to some sort of really good stock ideas. I understand you've bought just recently. JD Sports, obviously the sports retailer, which has got a big presence, I think, into the States. And take me through that one, because how come you've gone for JD Sports, say, instead of Frasier? And also, you know, in terms of the sort of secular growth in that whole sort of athleisure area.
Well, it's more of a trade, this one, really, just on the consumer side, because I was sort of thinking, well, I noticed directors have been buying there at JD Sports quite recently, and they got rid of the old boss, Peter Cowgill.
Yeah.
And I was never a fan of Peter Cowgill. You know, he was involved with an AIM company some years ago, about 10 years ago, MUBL, MBL, they were called, a couple of brothers up north. Mm. And they had this little business, and it all went AIM, you know.
And
he was involved with that. and it all looked very suspicious. And he was also involved with United Carpets as well, which I think cover itself in glory, to be honest. So while he was...
Not a great track record.
No, and while he was there at JD Sports, you know, sort of I always avoided it. And then he finally left abruptly a year or so ago. They got a new board in there. One of the things about JD Sports is it's the biggest sports retailer in Europe. And I'm sat there thinking, you know, like they've got to be a big target at some point for one of the American companies that, you know, want to get in there into Europe. And they're trading on a pretty reasonable PE.
Yeah, 12 times, yeah.
Yeah.
And they've got a lot of cash.
Yeah, and they've got... sorry, Paul.
It's all right, turn it off. Somebody's ringing you. It must be Warren Buffett.
Yeah, yeah, that's where he is after a tip. With all the retail stocks at the moment about to make trading statements and stuff like that, they're due a trading statement soon, and it's just basically a buy on that. They've come off their where they were. They're below where the directors were buying, I think, and that's just basically a trade on that. And I'll see how they go in the next few
weeks. I think just as sort of investors, there's so much money now made in live sports that it's brought people on through the monetization of those franchises, the likes of obviously all the US sports, the NBA and the, you know, basically UFC and the Premiership. And it's meant there's lots of sales of high value sports equipment and, you know, sort of the fan base, just shirts and stuff like that. Yeah. I think they're probably, and any other types of monetization if they get off the back of it. So I think they're probably doing well and a good valuation. So yeah, that's something I'll look for.
Falling shipping costs as well. You know,
yeah, of course.
These baseball boots come in a big box, you know, and each one of those in boxes, they must have incredible shipping costs that are going to fall, you know, over the coming, you know, 6 months or so. So there's that tailwind for them as well.
Yeah, I would agree. I think sports leisure is a good area. Now, another one, Jet2, which I think is one of the biggest sort of like package holiday providers. It's got its own airline, a bit of the old sort of Thomas Cook previous model, but I think it's in a much better shape. And it came out with a positive trading update just recently, I think. In fact, I think it's sort of booked, its bookings for this summer are pretty high.
Yeah, you know, all the airlines seem to be doing quite well. And Jet2 is one I followed for 20-odd years. They were Dark Group, and they had one airplane.
Was it?
Yeah,
Dark
it was
Group. Dark Group. I didn't wonder where it went to.
One airplane, and he used to fly the plane himself across to Jersey and back again, and they'd whip the seats out.
Yeah.
They'd take mail over to Jersey on the plane on the way out there. They'd come back with a load of daffodils or something on the way back again, and then they'd whip the seats out and they'd do passenger flying in between and really milk every sort of pound he could get out of a plane. You know, gone from one plane to I forget what it is now, it's you know, about 170 odd planes. And you know, he knows how to run a business, Meeson, and he stepped aside now. They've got a new CEO there, but they're trading on a PE of about 9, and they've got and they've got £1 billion of unencumbered net cash as well there, $2 billion, you know, a billion of it's in customer deposits, but they've got another billion now. I'm just sort of thinking, you strip out the cash, that's a cheap PE for a well-run business, and I just don't understand why it's so cheap. That's the one thing that worries me at the moment. It's so incredibly cheap. I just wonder, is there something going on there that I don't know about as far as, you know, maybe acquiring something, and there's going to be a place in maybe, I don't know. It doesn't sound like their sort of thing, but I'm just surprised it's that cheap. So it's that cheap, I'm a bit cautious. But
I wouldn't know anything about sort of like, you know, a bit of M&A. I would say that when it comes to sort of JDB Sports and Jet2, both of them are trading because they're in that consumer area, and people have sort of like overlaid a cyclical tilt to sort of like a recession at the back end of this year. That's probably why the sentiment. And if you're right, and there's still a following wind in terms of the consumer throughout the year, and you've got a big margin of safety in terms of those ratios, etc., then you'll see a significant re-rating, I would have thought, in 2024 if we don't get a hard recession and the consumer retrenches.
Yeah, and he reinvested all the time we went through COVID. They were reinvesting while British Airways were cutting jobs and chopping bits of the business off. They were reinvesting in planes and paying their staff the full wages on furlough and everything. And so, you know, he's got happy staff, he's got a full complement of staff, and they're not struggling to get staff. So he's in a good position there. So I like Jet2 a lot.
Yeah, and I think, you know, sort of the pricing is very firm at the moment because yeah. they can't sell enough. Well, they're selling their book overall.
Yeah.
Now another one is distributor Kickwave, which I think was an IPO probably about 2 years ago, and it's a bit yep. like the Booker model, I understand, sort of doing distribution of impulse, sort of like food products and chilled products and frozen products to sort of like small independent retailers. Do you want to take us through this one? Because again, it's sort of like under the radar, it's trading at about 10 times PE.
Yeah, I think it's actually probably trading on a lower PE than that. Because okay. I believe one of the brokers, I forget which broker it is now, Canaccord, I think it is it? And they've got a 25.9 PE EPS,
yeah.
I think, for this year. But going forward, I think the EPS will be even higher. It floated... Yeah, okay. When all these AIM companies like Made.com floated about 18 months ago, just as the market was reaching its peak, and then, of course, PE ratios were too high for a lot of these things then, and they all just came, lots of them just came off. Mm. But he actually, Kitwave actually, it's the founding guy, Paul Young, who started it about 25, 35 years ago.
Is that the singer, is it?
Yeah, he's
wherever I put my hat.
Not the singer he was.
Okay.
So, but yeah, as it happens, he started it and they floated and they've had earnings upgrades. They've bought two companies down in the West Country and they buy, it's a buy to build business and they buy out of cash flow. Mm. And that's the only buy to build business to have, actually, in my opinion. Mm. You know, I see these companies that buy to build and they start issuing shares and it becomes, you know, like I forget what the film was, but that big plant in the corner that keeps saying, "Feed me." What was that? I don't remember the film.
Okay. It's like you're Day of the Triffids or something.
Yeah, sort of. And you just keep having to keep feeding this plant because there's more shares are issued. And in the end, it just, the bottom line where it comes to EPS just gets out of way. But because they're doing this out of free cash flow, you know, it's boosting the EPS no end. And I think they're probably going to come out and raise their guidance again in they've got a trading update about May the 4th, somewhere around there. And that should be another positive train up there. Booker got taken out on a PE of 25.7. Mm. I think Booker originally bought Macro on a PE of about 19. So a PE of around 8 and they're, you know, cash like mad is just, it's just fantastic. So.
Yeah, Canaccord have got a price target of £3.90. And you'd have thought in that whole sort of like, you know, grocery sector, it's very resilient, crikey. I mean, it's everyday sort of items, isn't it?
Yeah, and they just deliver to like shops, pubs, clubs, you know, news agents and stuff. And they don't compete. They're not really competing as much on price as actually having all the products that a store wants. Last thing a news agent wants is to go to one wholesaler and find you've got 70% of your stock and then you've got to go off to another wholesaler and find another bit here and end up running around three wholesalers on cash and carry all the time. Yeah. Someone who can deliver everything you want straight to your door, you know, cold food, chilled food, all the packaged foods and everything. Mm. So they've moved up there. They're the 14th biggest wholesaler in the country. I think they're probably 12th now after these couple of acquisitions they've made. And it's a business, that's a sector that's really fragmented. So there's always going to be a lot of acquisitions going on. There'll probably be a target down the line as they get bigger.
Mm. Yeah, you'd have thought also, you know, a lot of independents won't want to use Booker's because it relies on them in their competitor, doesn't it?
Tesco's. Yeah, yeah, you're just feeding your competitor to go exactly. to them. Yeah, so there's a grudge match going on there.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the last person they're going to go to. Now, in terms of retailers, because obviously you quite like that area, Card Factory, and I think, I mean, your portfolio seems to be the antithesis of all things small, you know, small cap, well, not sort of like lowly rated as like, you know, real good value. And Smart Factory is another one. It's on a 10 times PE ratio. Do you want to take us through this one? Because it isn't an area that would particularly sort of like strike you as sort of secular growth, sort of a retailer of all things greetings cards.
Well, Card Factory is my biggest holding. I've never held a position this size ever. And it is, I think it's one of the most underrated cheap stocks you could find. It throws off cash like nobody's business. Yeah. I think they're throwing off about 30 million of cash each year. Mm. I've seen the brokers say they could do a full free cash flow yield of 60 million a year
Wow. Okay.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, given a market cap, well, so an enterprise value of about sort of 400 million and a market cap of 270. I mean, that's basically what a 16th, isn't it? So it's about sort of 14% or something.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Enormous.
The great thing is that you know, people, you know, people, Clinton Cards website is just down continuously. They're closing shops. Paper Chase is gone. You look at Moonpig, they're struggling to raise any sales. Their sales are hardly growing. Funky Pigeon just said their sales are down from 22 million to 18 million. So they're all struggling. So people sit there and say, oh, Car Factory must be exactly the same. You know, how can they be bucking the trend? But the thing about Car Factory is they make their own cards. And so they produce them all up in Wigan. And, you know, they've got a huge capacity up there as well. They export cards out to Australia. And also, what people don't realise is it's also become a gift shop now. They've got a massive amount of gifts on their side. So you go in a shop to buy a card for £1.50, and then you pick up a £5 little teddy bear to go with the card. Yeah. So it boosts their sales enormously, which is why their sales are rocketing. They've got a great new guy in there. The CEO is Darcy Wilson-Reimer. He started off at Cost Cutters. Mm. He had 9 years at Cost Cutters competing with Tesco's, Sainsbury's, all that. So if anybody knows how to keep your prices down and how to keep your costs down, it's this guy. And he's come in 2 years ago, and he's just, you know, he's just fantastic. Him and he's brought on board Richard Whiteside, who was the CEO of Greggs as a non-executive director. So as I say, they're two weapons grade retailer guys there. And I think that's going big. They brought out in November, they raised their profit guidance by about 10%. And then in January, they raised their profits guidance again by 10%. And then last week, they raised their profit guidance again 8% because the auditors were a week late. Well, that's been happening to several companies lately audits ain't got the staff. And so initially, people panicked and said, oh, you know, the results going to be a week late. Auditors, it's all horrible. But with that, people read the trading statement, they've raised their guidance again. I think their profits have gone. October, they're forecast to do 34 million. They're now going to do 54 million, which is a massive rise in your profits over. And when you've got that momentum where you keep coming out and saying, we're raising our profits again, we're raising our profit guidance again, you know, the company's got momentum behind it as well. And, you know, they paid down debt through COVID at an enormous rate and didn't have to have a £70 million placing that the finances suggested they should. So all in all, I think that's a fabulous stock. It used to trade at £4, and I reckon they'll get their earnings back to record earnings soon. And, you know, they can't stay trading at a pound when they're making the sort of money and they're generating the cash that they're generating, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And looking at their margins, I mean, they've done EBIT margins and 11% plus, and which is just fabulous for a retailer, never mind a card retailer. Yeah. So they're obviously doing something right, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, at the other end of the spectrum is sort of like Watches of Switzerland, which does all things sort of Cartier and all these very expensive jewellery and stuff like that. Do you want to take us through what sort of attracted you to that one? Because it's sort of like... it's a bit slightly more expensive, about 15 times, but obviously at the high end, I don't know, a lot of sort of well-heeled people in Knightsbridge are still buying watches.
Yeah, in Birmingham as well, I think, Paul.
No, we steal them.
Yeah. That's why I've always never wanted one. I knew someone had one.
You'll come to Birmingham if you want a cheap one.
Yeah. So, but no, they've since they've floated, they're just, you know, they've done about 20%. I think their compound annual growth rate over those years is about 20% earnings. And they're trading on a PE of about 15.
Yeah.
So that's a low peg for a company that's growing earnings at that sort of rate. Mm. And I've just recently bought back in. I've had a couple of goes buying them for a trade. And it hasn't come good in the last two trading updates. They've had a run-up before, and then their statements come out, and it's been disappointing. But it hasn't been really disappointing, but the market's just sold off on the thing. Mm. But I think this time maybe they're looking that cheap now that as long as things are going as the way they were going and they can maintain that 20% earnings growth rate that they've done and they're trading on a PE of 15, then I think that's you know, growth at a reasonable price. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at LVMH, who are obviously the world's biggest luxury brand, they put out some outstanding first quarter numbers on the back of the Chinese reopening and the traveling. And obviously, you know, Watches of Switzerland have a lot of their shops in airports. And if they do get that Asian rebound and they can't get these expensive watches in China because they're not allowed to sell them, then they're going to be making, you know, going to be hand over fist in airports around in off sort of like duty retail outlets, aren't they?
Well, someone said to me, it's all these money launderers as well. The money goes straight into a Rolex. You know, how do we get rid of this cash? Yeah, we get straight into a Rolex. I don't know. It's all shipped around and stuff, but I should imagine there's some, you know, some not on Watches of Switzerland's part, but the customers that go there,
that's
probably spending some money that comes from dubious.
Yeah. What about, let's move on to Marks & Spencer, which is an amazing one, because I've never invested them, but I remember Richard Green having a look at them back in the early 2000s. I think he put a bid in at £3.30, and from that moment onwards, I've never ever got anywhere. Do you want to take us through what's sort of like, you know, sort of intrigued you about this one? Because I know it does have a lot of property, doesn't it?
And
asset backing.
You know, I watched them. What was his name? Rowe was the last CEO and he had a good go, but he struggled. But this Stuart Machin's got in there, and you know, we shop in Marks & Spencer's.
You know, You're the only one, aren't you?
No. When I go there,
you have the whole shop to yourself.
That's packed. Honestly, the food department is packed. And when you have a look at their website now, you know, for years I've gone on there, you know, I get my underpants on there and everything else. Marks & Spencer, too much detail, sorry. But the websites has really improved as well. You know, they're shipping and everything. You can actually see things have tangibly improved in there. Well, the food's fantastic. It's always been good.
Yes, it has.
Recently it has got fabulous. And, you know, Christmas, they must have had a whale of a time. Mm. They've done this bit with Ocado. They're selling via Ocado, and they're going to put more products on Ocado now. And they're now closing a lot of smaller stores in the high street and opening these big stores, you know, mega stores that they're doing that'll have everything in there, the food, the big home stuff and everything else. They do glasses now and stuff. And I can just feel that this company has changed over the last year or two. And that's what I like about being retail, is you can go in there and you can get a feel for what's going on. And this, you know, you can tangibly feel it with Marks & Spencer's. And I know it's all the brokers. So they did about 9 brokers did an upgrade within about a couple of weeks quite recently. And it seems like they're all getting on board with Marks & Spencer. But one of the interesting things is 20, 30 years ago, when I used to, you know, be investing just as a punter, when you looked at the list of shareholders in Marks & Spencer's, it was all funds and you know, every fund had Marks & Spencer's in there. Mm. Now I look on it, I think there's only 3, Schroders and a couple of others that have actually got shares, more than 3% of Marks & Spencer's shares. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, they start coming good again, you're going to start finding a lot of these, you know, funds are going to want to start getting. It used to be the go-to stock for everybody in a, you know, when you had a pension, have you got Marks & Spencer's in there? Glaxo and Marks & Spencer's were the things to
and
have in
Sainsbury's.
Sainsbury's, that was there, And, you know, all those days have ended, but what goes around comes around, you know, and I think you're seeing a improvement on the high street now, especially for these companies. The real ones you've got to have, who've got omni-channel, that can do online, mobile phone, and they can do on high street as well. And I think the thing people really like is things like click and collect. You know, a lot of people like to, in fact, Car Factory is just introducing that across all their stores as well, because you can, if you want to buy something, you can order it at night on a Friday night, Saturday night, or whatever, Sunday night. And then when you go to work next day, you can pick it up when you go in store. If you want to return something, you can return it and you can drop it off when you go to work on the Monday. But the beautiful thing is, it's not only is that convenient for customers, you get a customer into the store. So they come in there to take something back, and you can, instead of giving them cash, you can either sell them something else, or you can take something. They walk in and they, you know, like in Car Factory, go and buy a card, go and pick it up. And they see a little teddy bear, because they're in there, and they go and buy it, spend another £5. And that's the beauty of click and collect. And that's something the onliners haven't got, the Moonpigs and, you know, the ASOS and others that are all just online. And that's why they're struggling. You haven't got that physical retail presence.
Yeah, no, and they really struggle on the returns, don't they? Because people just return everything. The return rates are about 30%, and unless you've got some slick, efficient way of actually processing that, then it costs you an absolute fortune.
They're clothing hire companies today, ASOS. It's clothing hire. The girls order them on the Friday. They get here the Saturday. They wear them Saturday night and send them back Monday. And that's what ASOS and Boohoo basically are today. So, you know,
they'll have to change the name. Rather than As Seen on the Screen, it's As Seen on Saturday, and you can have it back Monday.
Exactly.
Now, another one. is Pro Cook, which is which is basically a really quite small sort of like a direct to consumer specialist kitchenware brand, I understand.
Yeah,
and it does all things sort of like, you know, I don't know, pans and all kinds of
stuff. That's it, knives and
was this one an IPO, was it as well?
They IPO'd about a couple of years ago. The interesting thing about them is it's run by a family, the Neil family, and they've kept about 70% of the shares.
Right.
So the danger is there that they could take it private again.
Delisted.
So that's the danger. But the guy listed the company, and it was in order to give a lot of their workers about £7 million worth of share options to have them engaged with the company. And also, 25 years, it's been run by the same family. They've still got the same guys running it. And you know, somebody who's run a company for 25 years probably knows what they're doing at that point. So there's risk involved to it. And I basically bought them at around about, I started buying at around about 27, 28p, I think it was. And they've gone up. I should have probably, they more or less doubled, and I should have probably sold at that point and got back out. But I do think they've got the opportunity of seeing quite big tailwinds coming forward, because their shipping costs must be huge. Shipping all this, their stuff's made out in China. And when shipping costs come down, it's probably worth about a couple of million quid to them in shipping cost savings, which...
The pound has strengthened against the dollar, hasn't it? They're probably buying dollars from China.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a punt on them coming out and saying that we've done... Okay. And also Fackelmann, which is a big German company that do the same thing as ProCook, basically. They've got various brands in kitchen brands. They've taken 11% when the share price has been down here. So there's always that. If things get tough, Fackelmann are probably going to come in and take it out at this price anyway. So it sort of looks like you've got a bottom in there that's quite safe at this sort of level for me. Yeah. But, you know,
whenever you get a big TV series from Jamie Oliver or any of the other big chefs, presumably you get everybody decided to cook. Yeah. And if you go through a harder time, actually, they'll probably want to continue to sort of like, you know, cook more as well.
It's an interesting one, but a risky one. I wouldn't say, you know, it's very liquid as well. So,
just in terms of sort of size, I mean, you know, it's a 30 million market cap business. I mean, putting some money into it is, I mean, obviously you can probably do if you put $5 or $10 grand in, but if you want to put any more than that, I bet it's a bit of a struggle, isn't it?
Yeah, I had to buy bit by bit, actually, because you can move the price up just by buying 10,000 shares. You know, you're buying $3,000 or $6,000 worth at a go. You're moving the price up, and obviously when you want to sell them, you're moving the price down on yourself as well. So it's not one of those, if you're not one of those to be too long in if you're a small guy and you take too big a holding. But that's the issue there.
Yeah, it's a useful bit of advice.
And there's very little free float as well. You know, with a family holding 70% and Fackelmann 11%, there's only about 7% free float. So it's really tough.
Yeah. Another one in that sort of ilk, but it's a consumer brand, is Chapel Down. And this one is a sort of like a well-known English wine brand. I think it's based out in Kent, isn't it? In the chalk, sort of like South Downs way. And they make sparkling wines. I mean, I'm guessing you're probably a customer, so you thought, right, okay, I love the product so much, I'll buy part of the company, a bit like that Rimmington guy.
I do a bit of painting, and people often said I'm an artist.
Okay. Well, Van Gogh is the other guy. He must have been the guy who's calling then.
Yeah. So, having been an artist, a bit of an artist as well, they said you're buying the champagne or the sparkling wine, as you have to call it over here, has been it's one of my fortes. And I like Gus Born. I've drunk plenty of that, and that's a nice English sparkling wine. But the beauty is, out in France, the temperatures we're looking today, Spain, they're talking about 38 degrees. The vineyards down there are being baked to pieces, and they're not being able to produce the wine that they used to produce. And now the French are all looking up here at south coast of the UK, because we've got the perfect climate now, and we're producing wines better than, you know, half of France now. So they get great awards. Chapel Down was on Saturday Kitchen last weekend, being, you know, touted as one of the best wines they've tasted. So, and that's the thing. You know, they're increasing it. They've got a lot of assets. They've said that their assets are probably way over what the book value is. You know,
and they've got to expand. Can they expand? Can they? I mean, that must be the problem. I mean, buying land in the UK and the South Downs is not easy, I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah. You know, trying to get hold of land is difficult. But what you got to think about, it takes 5 years to get these vineyards planted up and growing proper wines. So over the course of time, you know, these French companies are probably sat there saying, well, let them pick, you know, they're growing the right grapes for them, you know, Pinot Noir and what the other Chardonnay and all the other three that they had grow for Champagne. They sit there buying up this land, planting them up, and in a few years' time, they're all going to be ready to give off a load of grapes and wine, and that's when the French will probably come knocking and say, hey, Tattinger have already been buying some places up around in the south coast. Mm. And so it's Kent, Sussex, Surrey and around there that are all the areas that they're going to like. Oh,
I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah. So it's quite interesting. They're expanding.
How do you value a company like this though? I mean, obviously it must be, you know, you've got an asset backing and then you've got obviously, you know, future growth and just the intangible value of the brand. And it's people like me and you who you can pick a bottle up with a specialist sort of like, you know, retailer or whatever.
Yeah. It's difficult to value. They were trading about a pound, you know, they plummeted all the way down to about 19 pence when I bought them at 19 pence. They've doubled since I first bought them.
Yeah.
But I trade on Aquis, so they're not easy to trade. And also, one of the things you've got to bear in mind is the weather. You know, you get one lousy year like they had last year, the year before last, and that knackers the whole vineyard, and you've got really low. So your profits get walloped on a one-year basis, and you've got to be prepared to live through something like that. So I wouldn't hold a massive holding in them now. You know, I've doubled my money, so I've taken a bit out. But you just got to have that bit of caution because of the weather. But I think they're cheap and they're expanding quick. And CFO bought a load more shares last week. Mm. So they're confident. You know, they've been buying. The directors have been buying there. So
I would agree. It can be
a lovely job.
It can be one of those sleeping sort of like assets that, you know, is a trophy to somebody at some point in time. I mean, if somebody, a well-known sommelier or chef or somebody on TV said, oh, flipping hell, I just love that sparkling wine from, I mean, this thing's going to fly, isn't it? I mean,
exactly.
You're going to get that huge short squeeze. Everybody's going to say, fabulous. I'll have six bottles of that, please.
Yeah. And the CEO's got the most fantastic job. He just goes around all the sporting events and gets pissed all the time. You know, you're there having a party. He's having a lovely time. You know, he's at Ascot. He's a smashing guy, Andrew Carter. And he's at Ascot. He's at the boat races. He's at all the show races. And they're promoting their brand great at all these things. He's doing a fantastic job. So
They just need a really good endorser. A sort of like, you know, Beckham or somebody like that decided to, rather than have his bottle of whatever it is,
For Superdry, didn't he? We wore a shirt and that made Superdry.
Yeah, exactly.
So
it's
that factor. Yeah, you just need one of them to come along and say.
Yeah. Now let's move on.
Also, one other little thing. ESG, you know, you're not shipping champagne all the way from France and Europe and New Zealand and that to the UK. It's made in the UK and you drink it in the UK. So there's that, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
Environmentally friendly bit to it as well. So
yeah, a bit like pork pies.
Yeah.
Made in the UK. And what about Port Marion? Because that's another iconic brand in the UK for sort of like, you know, fine china and ceramics and stuff like that. And again, I mean, I've actually been there. I've been the whole, you know, sort of like in that sort of the area up in, I think it's Wales or something.
That's it, yeah.
Lovely, absolutely beautiful. A bit like Celebration in Disneyland, you know. It's just
multicolours. It's like an explosion in an ice cream factory.
And exactly. Do you want to take us through this one? Because I know Paul Scott likes it as well, doesn't he? He's not.
Yeah, they've got about six brands. They've got Spode and Port Marion and everything. They do various brands of china and stuff. And you know, like they went through a tough patch a few years ago, but the CFO has moved up to CEO, Mike Raybould. Mm. And they're now ever so cheap on a PE
nine
basis.
Times,
So it's nine times. They pay a decent dividend. Mm. But going forward, they've got one thing they've got going for them is that energy prices are going to come down massively. Okay. And there's a lot of energy involved, although they've hedged. So further out, their energy costs are likely to come down. But also the shipping costs. They were talking to Paul and he interviewed them and they were saying that he worked out their actual shipping cost is about 8 million. The savings they can make is 8 million when the shipping prices come down. Because they're shipping loads of big, heavy things across from, being made in China. So that's one game that they're going to get going forward. And also they're doing a lot of stuff with robotics now. So like taking the labor out of it and going into robots. Well, the reason China competes with us is because they can do it with labor. But if you go into robots making this type of stuff, then you're cutting your cost even more. So I think down the line, they could be surprisingly good, you know, and it's worth listening to the Bulls interview with the guy, Mike Raybould. It's a good company. I like them. They're, you know, great. So the wife goes into Frost Garden Centre, and when she's in there, it's got all the Port Merion in there. We're around that, and then she's at the Wax Lyrical Candles, which they do, we're all around that as well. That's another brand that they've got. So that's been slow, but that's going to start picking up. So just a cheap, really cheap stock, and it looks... Yeah. It looks like it could, you know, well, could do a lot to me.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, when it comes to sort of like, you know, brand strength and recognition, certainly in the UK, and if they can internationalize that, then fabulous. In fact, the sort of blueprint is the final one, is Games Workshop, because, I mean, obviously, it's the Warhammer, and I remember I used to play in Dungeons & Dragons as a kid and stuff like that, and that's obviously taken off in the gaming, but now has been made into sort of TV series. I think it's Amazon have sort of like bought up the rights and this sort of stuff. Do you want to take this one? Because this has really just seemed to be a Harry Potter sort of explosion stock, really.
Well, do you know what? I should say probably about 10 years ago, I don't know, I trained about a fiver. I looked I say to me, mates, you know, when these guys finally find girlfriends, this whole hobby is going to finish.
They ain't going to sit how in wrong could you be?
Yeah, they ain't going to sit in their bedroom painting little plastic toys. You know, they're going to find girlfriends and it's all going to be over. Yeah. But there's this continuous generation of young guys coming up that want to stay in their bedroom and paint these little soldiers and stuff. And I know a few kids that do it as well. And I'm totally surprised by how they've managed to keep this going. And like you say, the reason I've bought it is because what they said about the Amazon deal. And, if that comes good, the royalties there could be huge. So, you know, you just don't know how big a scale this thing is. It could be a TV series just for a small mini series or something. But if it could be a length of films, like it could be another, what is it?
Well, they did the one for Lord of the Rings, and they put about $1 billion into it. And I would say, regardless of whether it's going to be a hit for Amazon, they're going to spend a shed load of money, and it's going to hugely publicise the Warhammer brand. So they're going to get sort of like a halo effect in terms of their gaming and their shops and the, you know, whatever they sell, figurines and games and all this sort of stuff. I mean, it just is effectively one massive advert for the company, isn't it?
Yeah, so
somebody's going to put an advertising budget for you, pay for it, of $1 billion. Well, yeah. I think you'd be a bit crazy not to accept that.
Yeah, there's a deal going to be done, I'm sure. It's just how big it is and, you know, how bigger effect, but it's going to have a positive effect for the company, definitely. And, you know, they pay a great dividend as well now. They've been banging out dividends, you know, fabulous dividends just recently. So, just looks cheap.
Yeah. Now let's move on to some sort of like, you know, the turnarounds, et cetera. And I guess this is your contrarian sort of like area or side of you. In fact, the rest of them are really contrarian, but certainly the turnarounds. Inspecs. Now this one is, again, I think it sort of IPO'd about 2 or 3 years ago, and it does sort of, it's got its own brands, its licensed brands in for glasses and stuff like that, you know, eyewear and glasses and lenses. And then it also does lenses, I think, for other third-party brand manufacturers. Do you want to take us to this one? Because it's had a good recovery, actually, hasn't it? It used to have a bit of debt, I think, but it's now sort of stabilised.
Yeah, they had a trading update this morning. They've still got debt, but the big thing was they bought a big German company just before about a couple of years ago, and it sort of quadruples their sales, you know, and they had a big placing and issued a load of shares, which diluted them. But the amount of sales they gained for it was huge, and the synergies that could be there and everything else when they get all this together. But of course, what happened was, Ukraine came along, Germany, it's a German company, and they got walloped. Germany absolutely got walloped. And their German business side was just, and they'd only just taken them on. So, you know, it was like bad luck really, as far as that goes. But the guy there is running it, his name's Totterman. He's a former UBS banker. He's just moved up to chairman, and they've brought in a guy from Luxottica to be CEO.
Okay.
And
he knows what he's doing then.
Yeah, exactly. So, the reason for buying that is they've come. Their last statement said they were in line. They've got a new CEO in from Luxottica, and it's a bet on him being, you know, knowing what he's doing, and we get a recovery there. And today they had a trading update today and said that
in line.
It said the broker forecasts have been fiddled a little bit recently, and that they came in with an adjusted EPS, which was 8 cents. But I've not looked at all the adjustments, but looking on Stockopedia, the forecasts have suddenly dropped in the last few days, like they've counted in an adjustment there, which wasn't adjusted. Right, okay. So it looks like a proper typical AIM fiddle. And we're now looking towards the year end, which I was looking forward towards anyway, because you're sort of looking to see what this new CEO does. They've come out today and said sales are picking up again and they're getting a rebound. And if they get the synergies out of this business in Germany and the rest of the stuff, and they've been expanding in Vietnam, they've got a place in Portugal there. Their skunk factory, it's called, America, it started making sales. There's a lot of stuff that's ready to, you know, be a tailwind from here when they're getting the sales back from Germany as well. So it's a risky one. They've got debt, and they had to avoid breaching a covenant at one point. Now, a covenant was waived, I think. So it's not a
widow's orphan.
No, definitely not. You know, if you're on the safe side of things, you don't want to be, you know, playing with something like this. But for a recovery play with a small bit of money, you know, it looks interesting play. And because his glasses, the margins in these things must be huge.
Yeah, prescription lenses.
Well, they knocked out even the frames. You know, you pay like blooming £100 for the frames, and they're probably knocked out a pound of time in Vietnam by some little sweatshop. And that's where the margins are. But, you know, we'll see.
Well, people are prepared to pay it. So, you know.
Yeah, they do, don't they? It's the value they
perceive on it. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Now, another one which is in the turnaround, which seems to be a perennial turnaround, is Mothercare. And I remember when we used to have, when we had our kids like 25, 26 years ago, that was our sort of go-to shop for sort of all things, sort of buggies and stuff like that. And then it's just really gone through, you know, really gone through the mill, hasn't it? And, it's moved on down to more of a franchise model international. Do you want to take us through this one?
Well, they're almost a drop shipper now. They sort of basically get stuff made out in the Far East and they deliver it straight to their franchise stores.
Yeah.
And they just manage the delivery and the, you know, the system. And it's quite interesting because I've followed them for a while. Well, I followed them for ages, and they a couple of times I bought in when Mark Newton Jones, he became the CEO. He used to be the CEO of, I forget what the parent brand is, but they own Very and a couple of others. And he'd got a good reputation as CEO. He came in, he did his best, but, you know, trying to have high street stores just doesn't work. So they moved to this sort of like asset-light business that they've got now. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is that they've got a pension deficit, which was about 120 million pension deficit. And recently that's come down to 42 million. And they said in their last statement, you know, this could be even lower if, depending the way interest rates go at the moment, and they look at it. So I think the pension deficit is probably coming down to a really, they've got to pay £1 million in the pension deficit this year. And then it goes up 2 and it's like 3. So it goes up about £1 million a year. They've got to keep adding that they pay this. But that may all be reducing because the pension deficit's probably come down a lot more. And they said that may be less than expected. One of the other things is, they've got this new CEO in. I can never remember his name, but he's got a good track record. He's got a good track record.
Daniel
it's a French name, isn't it?
Yeah, Le Conte. Yeah,
that's it.
Le Conte, yeah.
Yeah, so they got him in, and Mark Jones had gone as a... He didn't leave the company. He stayed as a non-executive director. Well, he just sold, I think it was 900,000 shares at about 8 pence. Just before the CEO had arrived. And then suddenly after the CEO arrived, he bought £600,000 back at 10 pence. And this is, I said, why has he suddenly bought shares back? Yeah. Just after CEO, unless this CEO switched the light on and said, if we do this and we do that, and it's, you know, a light switch. And so he bought 600,000 shares back. And it just seems strange to me that you'd buy them back at 2 pence more than you just sold them for any other.
So what was the reason?
I don't know the reason yet. They've got a trading statement coming out soon.
Okay, right, fine.
So it's a play on that and see what happens. But they've always been, they always look like they've got the capability of being shipping because they got hit by Russia. They were in Russia.
Yeah.
Okay. And they took a bit of a whack on that. So maybe all the dirty, filthy stuff's out of it now. And it's got the, you know, the pension deficit's coming down and they're going to make clean profits. And that, I think they could make some really big profits going forward. And the directors have been buying. Clive Wiley, the chairman, has also been buying as well.
Okay.
And I don't know Clive Wiley, but when I spoke to Andy Brough once, when I said about it was Clive Wiley, he said he liked Clive Wiley. So that was a good endorsement. So
Yeah, absolutely.
It's I'm holding them. They're ever so liquid. They're high risk, like ProCook and, you know, a couple of others. But if you do this recovery thing, you know, you buy several of them and you expect one or two to go bad. Mm. You know, you expect bulk of them to go good or so you've just got to, if you...
Yeah, you've got to have broad shoulders and just expect that you treat it as a portfolio basket. And if you make money out of, you know, essentially one out of the three, the one which covers more than the losses and gives you a good return. So on with
it's
you.
Like and Dragon's Den, isn't it? You know, Dragon's Den, they punt, you know, 10 of these little guys and eight of them will probably go to the pan, but two will be fantastic. They'll be, hopefully this is reggae sauce.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that guy. He was great. Yeah. What was his name again? I can't remember.
Levi Roots.
Levi Roots. Yeah, he was fab, wasn't he? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but you're right in terms of you know, that's how you sort of with your portfolio construction. And as long as you're prepared to have a few sleepless nights occasionally, then that's absolutely fine. Now another one I know that Bruffy likes, or Andy Brough from Schroders, is Czar. Because it was a digital printhead manufacturer, I think, which used to do for ceramics, but has now sort of breached out to do other things for his digital printhead. So we'll take this one because it got really sold off a few years ago, came roaring back, and I think has had a couple of trading sort of mishaps recently. I don't know, but...
Yeah, I've followed them I watched their technology back in the 90s when they came up with these inkjet printers, and it was on Tomorrow's World.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like, you know, all this great thing, and because... They floated. They became. They actually do the printheads for wide form. Well, not wide format printers, but for inkjet printers, large inkjet printers, industrial ones. Mm. And they did okay for several years, but there was so much competition about at the time. But eventually, their technology is probably the top technology, probably the best technology in the world, to be honest. And they gambled all on ceramic tiles. And they took up 100% of the ceramic tile market just in no time, and the shares just went through the roof. They went up like a rocket. You can believe it. And because focusing on one thing, they let everything else go to the side, and they had bags of technology there. They're 3D printing and lots of other stuff. Long and short of it was they focused on this thing called thin film. Spent too much time on it. Anyway, the old ball got kicked out, and they brought this guy in, John Mills, who used to be an inker. And he's got a good reputation. He's been in there, and they're doing all the right things. I bought them back at 50p when Andy Brough...
So you've tripled your money.
He did. He beat me just to it.
You tipped him off, did you? Or something?
No. I'd got my eye on him, but when I saw he'd been in there and had a great big lump, I was in behind him in no time. So... I brought them down then, and they've come in, and the boss has walked in there, and in the back offices, they've got all this technology that they've not been using. These things for, you know, like the real thing that's going to kick in now is their Aqueous Aquinox, Edge, which prints water-based inkjet printing, which is good for the environment. And that should clean up because they can do thick inks. Much thicker, higher viscose inks. Well, t-shirt printing, if you print a t-shirt, you have to lay down a layer first on the t-shirt before you print inks on it, because otherwise it just goes into the t-shirt and just spreads out everywhere. And so they put this gummy layer down first, which seals the shirt, and then they print the color on. With this new inks, they'll be able to, because it's thicker, it will actually print straight onto the t-shirt, so it saves a whole process in the t-shirt. So that's one big savings area for any manufacturers. And now going forward, the big thing is, when you go forward, that they've never been involved in these big wide format inkjet printers that do posters and stuff like that. They've never done it. In 18 months time, they'll have the heads for that, and that is a huge market. So when they get into that, that's going to be where they really make their money, on the wide format inkjet printing. But between now they've got the Aqueous, which is the water-based inks. And they've got some other new heads coming out in between that, and then the big wire format in about 8 months' time. So from here, it's a long play. I banked a bit of profit. I've reduced quite a bit at the moment, but I'm there waiting to fill up again when I see the news come out And also they brought all their stuff back from China as well. They were manufacturing in China and they decided to have 3 months off, bring a load of stuff back from China and manufacture it here because of the delays and everything else, which is going to be an advantage over other companies with China having to bring it in from China. So they've got everything there and it looks, you know, it's ready to go, but you just need a bit of news flow to say that they're beating expectations and get the market excited, I think.
So when, just on the broad point, when it comes to sort of position sizing, obviously you've tripled your money on and done really well on Czar, et cetera. At what point do you decide to sort of like, you know, top slice and take a bit off the table?
I usually look around and see if I can find anything cheaper. I
mean, when like cheap, Card Factory.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, when you look in there, you buy something on a PE of like 5 or, you know, you sat there looking at it and you think you're buying a PE of 5 and then it re-rates and it goes up and it's, you know, might have gone up 6-fold. You sit there and I think to myself, well, do I want to keep hold of it here? And what's the PE value? And how far can it grow at this point now? Having gone up 6-fold, how fast can it grow now for a PE, which is much higher? Mm. And then I look around and see if I can find anything that looks really attractive on a much lower PE that's going to have a higher growth rate. And, you know,
do you have any maximum at all in terms of your position size? 10%, 15, 20, 25?
I always used to stick to 10%. I had like this rigid 10%.
That sounds as though you've got broader shoulders now.
Yeah, now actually, Car Factory is 30% of my portfolio.
30%. Wow, okay. Yeah. Well, at least you're putting your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, my money's where my mouth is, and I've never held a position that's 30% before. Part of that is growth of the stock, yeah, of course. Okay. You know, because I bought it down around in the 50s, 45.
Okay, so you've over doubled your money.
Doubled my money in there, but you know, the mistake I've made in the past is never to, you know, absolutely bet on your winners. You know, I should have really, when you're confident in something, run it. Well, I've run them, but I've never been in there big to start with. Mm. So this time I've sort of learned my lesson, I think. And I've, you know, maybe I haven't. Maybe I've really not learned my lesson, but I'm pretty sure, you know, I've looked at it and the cash flow and everything else there, that one, and you know, it's got all the rights. And the public just, you know, most investors just say, oh, cards.
Thing of
the past, young kids don't send them anymore, you know, like, but they're missing the fact that it's now a gift shop and it's expanding all over the world. And they plan to be the world's biggest card retailer. So, you know, they've got big plans and they've got good guys running it and they've delivered. That's the thing, you know, these guys get in there, and if you get a CEO comes in and he's got all the talk, you want to see things happen within 12 months when a new CEO comes in. Mm. You know, 18 months at the maximum. If they ain't delivering tangible changes within 18 months and you're not seeing it in the share price, you're probably not going to see it. But, you know, these have got in there and the share price moved straight away as soon as he was in there, and he's done all the right things. So,
well, yeah, I mean, Craig, well, you haven't done badly out of it either. 30% of your portfolio from about 15 or probably 10 or 15. So you've done pretty well. So what's your current cash holding at the moment? Have you got any spare cash? Because I know you've got we'll just cover one on your watch list, but what's sort of your cash position at the moment?
Pretty low at the moment.
Okay, yeah, so you're pretty fully. Yeah. Now, okay, so one on your watch list, I know, is on the Beach, which is again a sort of online travel company, which I guess probably is in line with your other thoughts on things like Jet2, isn't it? It's going to make hay this year.
Yeah, you know, they're cheap and they've got net cash, and you would think the way holidays are going, they should be doing really well. They've had a couple of statements that haven't been as sparkling as you would have hoped at this sort of thing, and people have sold off. So I'm a tad cautious on them.
Yeah, okay.
I think I'd probably be more into Jet2 than I would be out on the Beach. But if they've got their act together and they're, you know, they've been targeting higher price holidays instead of going for the cheap end of things, and the CEO there, former CEO, he's now moved on, higher up into the company, he's taken a back seat. He was buying 6 months ago a big stake, having already sold out quite a lot of shares, but he's back buying again. And it should be a sector where they should be making money. If they're not making money now, then there's something wrong there, because everybody's on holiday, everybody's had COVID, and they've decided they're going to live their life and enjoy themselves and, you know, forget buying a new car. We don't know whether we want electric, diesel, petrol or hydrogen, or what the next new car is going to be. So they've stopped all their car buying and they're out enjoying holidays and they're not buying bits and things. So
yeah, it's a life is too short.
Bowling at the bowling alleys, they're doing well, and they're going on holiday, they're off to the restaurant, and they're going to spend the money before they get the next virus.
Yeah, no, good idea. Well, thanks very much, Richard. Brilliant insights. Gives a lot, investors a lot to have a look through and do a bit of research on. And most of the actual companies we talked about are really cheap. I mean, even on the mark, even on the beach, is only trading at 10 times. So yeah. Lots of really, really good value stocks and contrarian plays. And yeah. If investors want to sort of like... sort of sign up to the Cockney Rebel service or so whatever, you know, the actual, I think you've got something on Substack, haven't you?
Yeah.
How best to do that?
If they go to Twitter, and my Twitter handle is Rebel at Rebel HQ, at Rebel HQ, they'll see me on Twitter, or if they go to Substack, if they search Substack Card Factory, if they search Substack Card Factory, they'll find a, okay. My Substack in there because I did a car factory on it. So
brilliant. Yeah, and I guess that's the first place that if anybody wants to know how Andy Brough and Paul Scott are positioning their portfolios and getting inside track on a stock, that's the first place they're going to find out, isn't it? Is your account?
Yeah, I hope so.
All right, take care. Thanks very much, right, Richard.
Nice to speak, Paul.
Touching base in 6
Cheers.
Months' time.
Thank Thanks. You. Cheers. Bye bye. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.